You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In 1995, a Japanese schoolgirl was abducted and sexually assaulted by three U.S. soldiers in Okinawa. Police demanded that the suspects be handed over to Japan, but the U.S. forces refused to do so. This incident angered the public and rallies were held. They strongly demanded a revision of the treaty with the U.S. and the reduction of bases. Fast forward to September of this year. In Korea, a U.S. soldier broke into the dorm of a high school student, threatened her with a weapon, and repeatedly sexually assaulted her. Again, this outraged locals. Aside from the criminal issues, these incidents raise a basic question. Why are there soldiers in Japan and Korea at all? Christine Ahn is executive director of the Korea Policy Institute. She's a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus, and she's joined me on the phone. Hi, Christine, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thank you, Mordecai.
The U.S. has an amazing, astounding, impossible number of bases around the world, but give us some idea of the scope of U.S. bases across the Asia-Pacific area.
Well, I would say that it's really difficult to kind of pinpoint the actual number because, as you can imagine, the Pentagon hasn't been very transparent about the actual numbers. They might project and say there's about 650 bases around the world, but in fact, when you include the secret installations, outposts, you know, surveillance sites, a lot of base analysts will say that it is upwards to 1,000 of these military outposts and bases around the world. In the Asia Pacific, I have been an expert on U.S.-Korea relations. The U.S. has been in the Asia Pacific for a very long time, and in fact, I would say that it started in the Asia Pacific, where the U.S. really began its forward march towards empire, and then, of course, the role that these bases play. So, on the Korean Peninsula, there are currently about 86 bases and these satellite sites and outposts, and they have been there since 1945, essentially. There has been a slight decrease in recent years, largely because of the protests by the Korean people calling for their removal. There are, I think similar amounts in Okinawa or in Japan. And one thing that the Okinawans like to point out is that the majority are concentrated in their territory, whereas versus the main land of Japan. So the bases have been that's the thing, is that most Americans, one, don't even realize the kind of reach and the scope of the U.S. military bases. But secondly, they are not aware of how much opposition there is to these bases. And, it's an unfortunate thing that these sex crimes by U.S. troops, violent sex crimes by U.S. troops against the civilian population, is used as an opportunity, though, to bring into the public discourse about the role of U.S. bases. And In fact, after my article came out about the role of the U.S. troop that brutally sexually assaulted the teenage girl, within a week there was another case of that. So in fact, right now this has become a major issue in South Korea again, where the civilian population has been saying there have been over 100,000 criminal cases committed by U.S. troops against the civilian population. And because of the Status of Forces Agreement between the two countries, there is a kind of extrajudiciality in which these soldiers act in impunity against the Korean civilian population. So the scary thing, though, is recent articles by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and a recent trip to Asia by Leon Panetta, the new defense secretary. And, the message is there might be calls within the United States to close down some bases, including even from members of Congress. But the thing is that the 21st century is America's Pacific century. And just the irony is that it's kind of come full loop, because actually last century was also America's Pacific century. But it just shows a kind of a recommitment by the U.S. military to both increase the military presence and by, you know, increasing the number of bases, which is not what the people in the Asia-Pacific are calling for.
In Iraq, recently America's having to pull out a large number, they say all, but certainly a very extensive number of their occupying army, because the government of Iraq refuses to grant immunity, the kind of immunity I guess you've referred to that exists for U.S. Military in South Korea and in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting development, that of all the reasons for the U.S. to be withdrawing from Iraq, it's because they couldn't get the kind of arrangements that they got with countries in the Philippines and Japan and Korea about the status of forces agreement, in which, you know, the U.S. troops will be granted immunity. I think it's a really positive sign. I think, you know, I'm sure the peace movement in this country, I'm sure the families of the veterans, I'm sure the veterans themselves would say, you know, any reason to bring the troops home is a good reason. So, but I think it's a very interesting development that of all the reasons, this is it. But it still does not clean the hands of the United States for the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who unfortunately both directly suffered from as casualties of war, and also because of the massive poverty that has been caused by this, you know, 8-year war. But it's really interesting because related to the kind of unequal agreements, one issue that has really emerged on the Korean Peninsula is about a naval base off the southern coast of the peninsula called, it's called Jeju Island. And actually very few people know about what is happening there, but because of I think the growing tensions between China and the United States, or I guess that's a very fair, very apolitical way of putting it, but essentially because of the rising economic power of China and the U.S. essentially feeling very uncomfortable by being replaced by China as the world's economic superpower, that I think that's part of the strategy for why the U.S. wants to increase its military presence. And so a lot of experts will say that there is sort of this crescent-shaped arc of U.S. bases that is encircling China. And in fact, there is a naval base that is being built right now on this island called Jeju. And it's really interesting that a lot of there's a lot of question, is this a U.S. base? Is this a South Korean base? And, you know, a lot of experts from South Korea will say it doesn't matter if it's a U.S. or a South Korean base. This is, yes, officially it is being built by the South Korean Navy and the military, but in fact, because of the mutual defense agreement between the U.S. and South Korea, the U.S. has full right. They don't even have to ask South Korea, essentially, whether they could land or use their airfields or dock in South Korean naval ports. So, you know, there is a lot of question about why is this base being built, when in fact South Korea is, China is South Korea's largest trading partner, when they have perfectly, you know, fine relations, in fact, a very strong economic relationship. Why is this base being built? And, you know, there is a lot of suspicion that the U.S. Needs this base for its, you know, part of its missile defense system. So There is a massive resistance underway right now in a village called Kangjiang. They're fighting against the undemocratic process in which their base was selected as the site. And people could learn more about it if they go to savejejuisland.org. But I would say that this resistance is inspiring so many of the other communities throughout the Asia Pacific, in Guam, in Okinawa, in the Philippines, who have so long endured the resistance themselves against the removal or for the removal of the U.S. bases. And so I think that this is really kind of catalyzing and inspiring this movement. And it's just been really great to see so many foras in which all these groups are coming together in these transnational forums. For example, in Hawaii at the APEC summit in November, there will be, you know, activists from all over the Asia Pacific coming together to try to share strategies and, you know, share an analysis so that, I mean, especially between Okinawa and Guam, where, you know, 8,000 U.S. Marines were to be transferred from Okinawa to Guam, you know, there was incredible solidarity. And right now, I think because of the incredible organizing and the education that has gone into what this would mean for the people of Guam, and the Okinawans are saying, you know, nobody wants U.S. troops, so take them back to the mainland, that, it, you know, it has resulted in, right now, there is a stasis where even calls from the Senate Armed Services Committee in the United States to say we need to hold off on this relocation plan because, and then back to, you know, we are in an economic crisis and we need to really figure out what the U.S. can afford. And, you know, that's the thing I point out in my article is it's, you know, we've definitely had conversations in this country about the bloated military budget, but I would say it's historic. It's the first time that there are calls by even members of Congress to say we need to close down the number of U.S. bases around the world.
When we get to the government level, and I'm wondering, the South Korean government itself or the Japanese government, are there any indications of some significant sectors of the political structures of those two countries being in opposition to the existence of the bases?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say it's right now very different. I mean, you have a situation where in Okinawa, the governor of Okinawa is very opposed to the relocation of troops. And he is, you know, he is a product of the civil society movements that have been calling for the withdrawal of bases. So I think you have a very nice alignment in Okinawa. The problem is that Japan is, you know, right now you have a prime minister that is, you know, calling to, you know, is essentially, I mean, I would say Japan and South Korea both have been in an unequal relationship because of, I mean, I think the mutual defenses agreement that I talked about, where essentially U.S. Military can just sort of roughshod all over the country of both countries. And so I think this unequal relationship that has been going on for over 68 years, you know, makes it so much that their hands are tied. And so in the case of South Korea, you know, you had before this current regime in power, two successive administrations, Kim Dae-jung, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his engagement with North Korea, and then Noh Myung-hyun. And those two administrations actually really wanted the gradual decrease and to have a withdrawal eventually of U.S. troops. And I think part of that is like why the base was decided on Jeju Island by Noh Myung-hyun in 2005, because he wanted to have a stronger South Korean military that was sort of free from, you know, when the U.S. eventually withdrew. But what is interesting is up until 2015, the U.S. will have wartime operational control over South Korea in that is in times of war, but, you know, that still means that they have so much significant control and direction over how decisions are made about bases or what kind of military strategy against North Korea, or even the massive amounts of joint military exercises that take place on the Korean Peninsula. So I think that, you know, that's like the systemic problem in which, you know, I think that the people, the civil society, the democracies within those countries always kind of run up against a brick wall in terms of what can and cannot be achieved. I think that the example of Prime Minister Hatoyama in 2009 when he was elected, you know, he was on a platform of saying, you know, he's going to essentially call for the eventual withdrawal of U.S. troops from Japan. Well, that guy didn't last very long. You know, he eventually resigned because he said, you know, he failed to follow through on that commitment. And, you know,
well, we'll
I
have
think it's perennial problem.
Right. Well, with that brick wall and still the protests developing in places like Jeju, we'll leave it there for now. And thank you very much for explaining the dynamics that's happening in the current time. Thank you,
Thanks
Christine.
Thank you so much, Mordecai. Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been speaking with Christine Ahn. She's Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute. She's also a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus. You can read her article. She referred to it in the interview on U.S. bases in the Pacific. It's at this website, fpif.org.